Some thyroid cancer patients have questions about their disease and radiation from the Three Mile Island nuclear accident.
I think as soon as I got over the initial shock, it's like, oh my gosh, I wonder if these two things are related.
I'm Kara Holsapple. This week on the Allegheny Front, the 40th anniversary of the partial meltdown at Three Mile Island has some taking another look at thyroid cancer rates in Pennsylvania. And critics of the Green New Deal say healthcare and jobs are great, but cutting carbon takes precedence.
If you believe that it really is an emergency situation, then let's take that up first.
Plus, recycling makes us feel good, but it might not be the planet saver we thought it was.
Recycling is not the right answer. Recycling is a last resort for materials that you otherwise can't avoid.
Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. The nuclear watchdog group Three Mile Island Alert is asking federal regulators to analyze what it calls a potentially dangerous condition at Exelon's Three Mile Island power plant outside of Harrisburg. State Impact Pennsylvania's Marie Cusick reports.
The group says it has been unsuccessfully trying to get the attention of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission on this issue for years. The concern is over what's known as steam generator tubes, which were installed at Three Mile Island in 2010, but found by Exelon to be malfunctioning less than 2 years later. A Three Mile Island Alert spokesman said there are design and manufacturing defects in the tubes that cause them to rub against each other, a potentially dangerous scenario that could lead to the release of radiation. A spokesman for the plant said the tubes are inspected every 2 years and that there's a comprehensive monitoring and maintenance plan in place. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission said the steam generators meet all code and design requirements. Marie Cusick, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
Later in the show, we'll have another story about the Three Mile Island nuclear generating station and questions about radiation from the 1979 partial meltdown there. But first, by now, you certainly have heard of the Green New Deal. It was introduced by Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Senator Edward Markey as a policy resolution that Congress could soon vote on. But what are they voting on? Well, it's a broad proposal to deal with climate change by quickly moving to renewable energy and redesigning the transportation system. At the same time, it calls for jobs that will pay a family-sustaining wage and access to higher education. The policy resolution has been championed by many, but also roundly criticized. The editorial board of the Washington Post argued that the Green New Deal isn't laser-focused on saving the planet because it's been, quote, muddled by social policy. For our podcast, Trump on Earth, the Allegheny Front's Julie Grant wanted to understand more about this line of thinking. So she talked with former Republican Congressman Bob Inglis of South Carolina. He's executive director of a nonprofit organization called RepublicEN.org. That's with an E-N. Here's Julie.
Hi, Congressman.
Hello. Great to be with you.
And in RepublicEN, the E-N stands for...
energy and enterprise and environment and all those good things.
So maybe we could start with you describing the organization. What is RepublicEN.org?
We're a group of conservatives out to convince fellow conservatives to step forward and enter the competition of ideas about climate change solutions. Thus far, the climate change conversation has mostly been conducted in the language of the left. Doing with less, repenting, corporations are evil, those sorts of things. Well, that's a conversation that conservatives can't enter. So we go to them and we say, you know, let's talk about energy abundance, more energy, more mobility, more freedom. Let's talk about the power of the free enterprise system to innovate and the power of market signals. And we're literally on the ground with conservatives in target districts. It's educational work that we do, but it's also education with a point of view that that conservatives have a lot to offer here, and that this is a problem with a solution if we engage with free enterprise principles.
Yeah, and so when you heard about the Green New Deal and the introduction of this broad resolution, what was your reaction?
I really appreciate the sentiment of the Green New Deal. It is a reality that we need to act quickly to avoid the worst of climate change. But the solution, of course, is, I think, in free enterprise and in a simple internalization of the negative externalities. I know that makes me sound like an economist, but I'm not an economist. It basically just means put all the cost in on all the fuels through a carbon tax, pair that tax with a dollar for dollar reduction in other taxes or a dividend of all of the money back to the people, apply it at the borders, collect it from those countries that don't have such a tax, and then the free enterprise system will sort this out. We're all complicit in this. You know, it's not that ExxonMobil is some terrible group of people. I use their product. I'm completely complicit with them in creating CO2 emissions. And so the question is, how do you innovate? How do you get to the place where we're driving electric cars on sunshine from our roofs and our garages? And that will come through free enterprise innovation, not by punishing corporations, but rather by recognizing them as innovators.
I want to explore this carbon tax or carbon pricing idea, but let's just go back for a second. So when we talk about the Green New Deal and some of these broader social policy objectives in there, the jobs portion, for example, the economic equalization idea, and some say that's an essential part of climate policy, but it sounds like you disagree with that.
Yeah, you know, I was in Congress when in 1993, when a brand new president, Bill Clinton, was attempting to do health care, and Hillary Clinton was on the Hill testifying. It basically consumed that entire Congress. Time went by, and then came another Congress, and Barack Obama was president. It essentially consumed that Congress. That was for one element that's proposed in the Green New Deal. So what I would say to people who are supporting the Green New Deal, let's not try to solve all the problems of the world in one piece of legislation. If we're really concerned about climate change being the thing that we must address quickly, then okay, let's address it quickly, and let's not try to carry along with it all these other things that would make it much more difficult to get passage.
Yeah, and so you were talking about a carbon tax, is that what you would call it?
Yeah. Some people like to call it a fee and avoid the word tax, but it's a tax. But the key to it is that it's paired with a reduction in other taxes or a dividend of all of the money back to the taxpayer. And so this pricing of carbon dioxide is a way of correcting the market distortion that exists in the lack of accountability for the cost associated with the burning of fossil fuels.
So, you know, some might say, well, I mean, I guess you are addressing this in some way, but I'm just trying to understand your program a little. This is different from, say, President Obama's Clean Power Plan that tried to reduce carbon coming from coal plants and other power, you know, electricity producers.
That's right. President Obama proposed a regulatory approach, and that's a respectable approach. It's just one that doesn't warm the hearts of conservatives like me and the people we're trying to reach at republicen.org. What warms our hearts is what Milton Friedman said to do one time on the Phil Donahue show, when Phil Donahue asked him, well, what do you do, Dr. Friedman, one of Reagan's economics advisors, about pollution if you don't want to regulate it? And Friedman says, well, you tax it, of course. You tax pollution. And that is a rock solid conservative approach to dealing with the problem of pollution. Is you bring accountability to those emissions, and you make it so that the product produced in that process bears its full cost and presents that full cost to the audience of the market. And when that market sees the true cost, it says, whoa, give me something else. This is too expensive. And so at that point, wind and solar and better nuclear do better than coal, for example, and put coal out of business.
What are you seeing from Republicans, from conservatives? Are you getting folks on board here? Are you seeing more and more support for this? Do you think you have any chance at passage of something along these lines?
things are beginning to move. It's very exciting. On February the 6th, for example, the headline from the Republican side of the Energy and Commerce Committee in the House really said it all. That headline read, "Republicans are focused on pragmatic solutions to climate change." It's a huge switch from the previous Congress. Part of that may be political or it may be substantive. Just the awareness that comes from Hurricane Florence dropping 50% more rain on North Carolina, or the fires in California, or droughts in other places. We're all experiencing climate change, and it's coming closer to us.
And what about some of these other ideas in the Green New Deal? How do we move forward with the need for sustaining wages for families, with retrofitting buildings and the transportation system, and energy efficiency and moving to renewable energy? How do we move forward in all those kind of social policies that are addressed in the Green New Deal?
Along with healthcare and other things. Yeah. And so
right.
It's all those things are surely worthy of Congress's attention. It's just that if you believe that it's that it really is an emergency situation, then let's take that up first. And then deal later with a huge debate, for example, on universal basic income. There's a good debate to be had on that, but for goodness sakes, it is a huge decision. It's sort of like trying to have open heart surgery at the same time that you're having a knee replacement. You really wouldn't do that. You would probably put off the knee replacement while you're doing the open heart surgery. Recover from the open heart surgery, and then let's talk about the knee replacement. Climate change is that open heart surgery. We can come back later and talk about the knee surgery of a universal basic income or a hip replacement of healthcare that covers all Americans. Those things can be taken up later after we get the heart pumping just right.
Former Republican Congressman Bob Inglis of South Carolina is executive director of a nonprofit organization called RepublicEN.org. The Allegheny Friends' Julie Grant spoke with Inglis about the Green New Deal for our podcast, Trump on Earth. For more perspectives, listen at TrumpOnEarth.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Glass bottles don't biodegrade in landfills. They're so durable, we don't even know how long they'll be around. But that's okay, because we can recycle them to make new bottles and jars. But some Pennsylvania residents are being told they can no longer recycle glass with their paper and aluminum cans at the curb like they have for years.
I was really upset about it.
Later on the Allegheny Front, what's going on with glass recycling? Stay tuned. Years ago, a Penn State School of Medicine study found that a certain type of thyroid cancer was common to people who had been near the Three Mile Island nuclear power plant in the aftermath of the partial meltdown in 1979. As part of a look at TMI 40 years later, Transforming Health's Brett Schultes examines how the study has restarted the discussion around health effects due to the incident.
We are on the northeast side, I believe, of campus. And we've got Lake Placida here.
Chris Achenbach Kimmel works in the occupational therapy department at Elizabethtown College. On a sunny day, the 54-year-old takes a walk around the lake on campus and a journey back in time to March 28, 1979. Chris was a 14-year-old freshman at Cedar Cliff High School in Camp Hill, Cumberland County.
So I think Cedar Cliff was about 14 miles from TMI.
Across the Susquehanna River, Three Mile Island's Reactor 2 was melting down.
Tonight, the plant looms like a pale ghost, the specter of potential meltdown hanging over this community. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission says the core has been extensively damaged.
Chris stayed with her family in Lemoyne while her dad hunkered down in Steelton at the Saab auto dealership he owned.
So I don't think we left town or did anything unusual except to keep ourselves glued to the television and the radio.
There is no imminent danger. That's the official advice tonight, but many people aren't buying it.
Those days faded to memory until a 2010 doctor's visit revealed she had thyroid cancer.
I think as soon as I got over the initial shock, it's like, oh my gosh, I wonder if these two things are related.
Chris says her doctor was not surprised when she brought up the TMI accident.
She said, oh yeah, we see an increased incidence here in the area. She goes, I see it all the time.
Let's break that down a bit. Pennsylvania has had the highest rate of thyroid cancer in the nation. The biggest hotspots are Pittsburgh and Philadelphia, not the mid-state. But for this part of the state, Chris's story is common. People blame TMI for their cancer, and some doctors say it could have been the case. Yet the nuclear industry's position has been that nobody was harmed, and Nuclear Regulatory Commission spokesman Neil Sheehan agrees.
That's not to say that there weren't any radioactive releases during the accident, but they were at such a low level that they would not be expected to have any sort of ill health effects.
Sheehan points to a University of Pittsburgh study he says shows there were no illnesses as a result of the event. But a recent study is calling that all into question.
The vast majority of patients who come here, Penn State Hershey, with thyroid cancer, attribute their thyroid cancer to 3 Mile Island.
That's Dr. David Goldenberg in his office at Penn State Health in Hershey.
Are these people right?
In 2017, Goldenberg released the results of a study he led. He used what was learned from the Chernobyl disaster in Russia to look for specific genetic markers that show up when thyroid cancer is caused by radiation.
We found a shift which absolutely can be attributed to exposure to radiation during the correct time frame for the Three Mile Island accident. And I know it's a frustrating answer, but further studies are needed because the people come out and say, well, it's a small study. They're right. It's a small study.
Goldenberg is quick to point out his work's limitations. Still, the study has put him in the middle of a 40-year-old debate. Did Three Mile Island release more radiation than the government says? Did it harm people?
And I don't really have any agenda one way or another. This was an interesting clinical question based on, you know, I face these patients every day of the week.
He says he's constantly turning people away who want him to study them, even though they don't fit the parameters. That is, people who were near the nuclear plant on that day and developed thyroid cancer, not other illnesses, within a certain window of time.
I say to these patients, I'm sorry, but I don't think that that's it. You know, I mean,
as a scientist, Goldenberg won't go past his data, and that can be frustrating.
The data goes where it goes, and the meaning is not any more than it is.
But while he says a lot of people wrongly attribute their cancer to the Three Mile Island accident, Goldenberg isn't ruling out it may have caused this one wave of thyroid cancer.
People see what they like to see, you know? But, you know, in this case, I think there actually was something there.
At the NRC, spokesman Neil Sheehan says he keeps an open mind, but his organization doesn't think the study proves anything.
We're always open to looking at new research that comes along, anything that might change our conclusions. But at this point, we have not seen that.
Sheehan says there was little radiation exposure, so it couldn't have added to cancer rates. But the NRC's position assumes those original estimates were indeed correct.
So, well, I take what they say, first of all, with a grain of salt. So if
in Elizabethtown, Chris Achenbach-Kimmel recognizes this is complicated stuff. Even now, 40 years later, she says when she was attending a thyroid cancer survivor support group, everyone believed the partial meltdown may have had a role. But she emphasizes she doesn't share the certainty that some of them had.
I'm going to say that probably the best way to characterize my opinion on that is the jury's still out.
Chris survived her cancer, and life goes on. She doesn't expect any apology or payout from the government. She's more worried that we, humans, didn't learn anything from this.
Well, as a Christian, I think that we all have a responsibility to be good stewards of what this earth gives us, what God gave us on this earth.
The irony isn't lost on Chris that nuclear power is seen by many people as one way to fight climate change, since they consider it clean energy. But the government still hasn't built a place for thousands of spent fuel rods that still sit at nuclear sites around the country.
So if we're taking that nuclear energy and what's left is this nuclear waste, what are we doing with that for future generations?
For her, nuclear power is not part of that solution. Chalk it up to her deep down suspicion that maybe, just maybe, it was TMI that caused her cancer after all. In Elizabethtown, I'm Brett Schultes.
Hudson Richards is like a lot of people in southwestern Pennsylvania. She was recently told she can no longer recycle glass with the rest of her residential recycling.
I was really upset about it.
She lives in an apartment complex in the suburbs north of Pittsburgh, and she says she didn't get a lot of advance notice from the trash hauler about the change or suggestions about what she should do with her glass bottles and jars. So at first, she reluctantly threw them in the trash compactor.
There are places where you can take glass in the greater Allegheny County area, but they're also quite a drive. So then you have to weigh, well, you know, I'm using gas to take glass to a recycling place. What's the carbon footprint? And it makes it much more difficult to both shop and consume on an environmentally conscious level.
Hudson Richards is an adjunct professor of history at the University of Pittsburgh and Duquesne University. Her focus is environmental history and food. She says now she's stockpiling glass in her garage and buying beer in cans.
Put pressure on your local administrations to figure out solutions to these issues because they have to be responsive to us.
As many municipalities in the region are discontinuing glass as part of residential recycling programs, a statewide environmental group is offering a solution. Justin Stockdale is the Western Regional Director for the Pennsylvania Resources Council, or PRC. And that's an organization that's long been an advocate for picking up litter and recycling responsibly. In addition to their other hard-to-recycle events, where people bring old electronics or paint cans, they've added a series of pop-up glass collection events around Pittsburgh. This change in recycling came, I think, as a surprise to many residents, but not to you. Tell me a little bit about the history of glass recycling and single-stream recycling, which is where you put your glass and aluminum and paper into one bin.
You know, if I think back to recycling when I first got involved in the recycling industry 25 years ago, we really managed commodities. We had drop-off centers where you put your one color glass in one bin, a different color in another. You put your paper over here. You put your this type of plastic in one bin, on and on. We managed individual discrete materials. That all changed in the 90s and 2000s with a move really chasing convenience, right? So we wanted more people to recycle, and to do that, we wanted to make it more convenient. Our tool to make it more convenient was throw it all into one bin and somebody else will sort it out. And what we found, again, even all the way back to the advent of single stream, was that putting glass in that bin was really problematic. It harmed equipment. Glass is a very abrasive material, so it does not perform well on conveyor belts. But more importantly, it contaminated other materials. So you were seeing paper bales leave these sorting facilities with piles of glass embedded into the paper. There's no real mechanical way to get the glass separated from all the other materials, just like there's no real mechanical way to get the other materials separated from the glass. These sorting facilities finally gave up and said it's not possible. And we, as the residents of southwestern Pennsylvania, are suffering that consequence.
Is this a problem statewide? What's happening in other parts of the state?
You're not seeing the same kind of shifts across Pennsylvania, and you're certainly not seeing it necessarily across the U.S. In suburban Philadelphia and in Philadelphia proper, what we're seeing is those sorting facilities are saying, we'll continue to take your glass, but we're going to charge you a lot more for the privilege. So the sorting facilities say their old cost for service to sort one ton of material might have been $50 a year ago. Today, it's over $100. Here in southwestern PA, the costs are going up, yes, but not nearly as high. And a big driver of that, or reason why it's not increasing so precipitously, is the removal of glass is that one challenging material in these sorting facilities. Nationally, there have been a lot of moves all over the country that are similar to what's happening here, whether it's truly removed out of the system. I can't find another place across the country that is impacted this immediately and directly as we are here in Southwest PA.
So I've heard that one of the reasons behind not picking up glass curbside anymore is that there's not a big market for glass recycling anymore. So what happens to the glass that's dropped off at these events?
The markets are not the challenge for glass. There are plenty of consuming mills out there. In fact, where we're sitting, we're probably within about a two-hour drive of as many as three large-scale industrial glass mills that consume nothing but waste glass to make new bottles and jars. So the market side, it's as valuable as it was when I got into this 25 years ago. You know, we don't see big market fluctuations. We don't see the value of it go up and down in big swings like we do with paper or with plastic. The challenge is getting it to those mills in a form and a shape and to a quality standard that they can actually use it.
You mentioned that glass recycling is a commodity. Can you say a little bit more about that? Because I think people think about recycling as like a duty and a responsibility, yeah, and they don't necessarily see it as the other end of it.
Yeah. So again, this is one of the failures, I think, of single stream, Kara, is that we have single stream sort of lulled us into this world of, well, if you put it in the bin magically, it's good for the environment, right? It will magically save the earth if we just put it in that blue bin rather than the black garbage can. And we really disconnected ourselves from the real reality of recycling. For something to be recycled, it has to be in demand as a raw material to produce something else. And if it's not that thing, it's not that commodity, then it's not recyclable. And so, you know, we've talked about plastics before. That's the best example of it. When we put all these various and sundry plastics in our recycling bin, well, you know, a big chunk of them are non-recyclable. Why? Because there's nobody using them as a raw material. So I think this, you know, all these changes we're having right now are actually a bit of a good thing, right? Because it's letting us go back to an understanding that recycling is more than just putting things in a different colored garbage can. It's about managing materials as commodities and as raw materials for manufacturing processes. And I think that connection is really important for people to acknowledge, to recognize. You know, recycling is not some magic thing that just, you know, the elves and the unicorns come out and save the planet with the recycling bin. That doesn't happen.
What does this like trend in recycling say about how we use materials or how, you know, how we consume materials?
PRC, what we do every day is try to challenge people to think about their waste very specifically and directly and ask themselves the question, do I need this product in the first place? That, you know, and this goes back to the very reality that recycling is not the right answer. Recycling is a last resort for materials that you otherwise can't avoid. There will always be packaging around mayonnaise or beverages. There's always going to be a package to go with it. And so we encourage people to think about, okay, what is the most responsible package they could possibly use. We really want to focus again on the materials, the packages that are the most recoverable, most recyclable. Glass is one of those packages, one of those materials. Glass can turn right back into a glass bottle over and over and over and over and over and over again, right? It's a pretty endless loop that it can return back to us. So glass is a very secure or safe commodity to use because it's highly recyclable. When we use it to make new bottles, it saves 90%+ of the energy that it would take to produce that glass bottle out of virgin materials. And so we don't want people to steer away from glass, right? That wouldn't be the answer. We'll just buy everything in plastic. Plastic is a different material, right? Plastic does not come back to us as the same container it was before. You recycle your old soda bottles and it's likely going to come back as carpet or fleece or insulation. It's not going to go through that repetitive cycle of being recycled the same way over and over again. So glass is an important commodity. We'd certainly don't encourage people to avoid glass because it's not recyclable in their curbside bin. But you have to be, you know, you have to think about your waste, right? That's what we really want people to do is to be conscious of the stuff they're consuming so they're then conscious about the stuff they're throwing away.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kara.
Justin Stockdale is the Western Regional Director for Pennsylvania Resources Council. He says at their first glass pop-up event in Pittsburgh South Hills, over 700 people dropped off 12 tons of glass for recycling. There's more at AlleghenyFront.org. Thanks for joining us on the Allegheny Front. You can always find us on Facebook and Twitter at Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of our show. I'm Carol Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, and the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation.